We will come to the first notes, which are July 68. Okay, I'm walking over to my table to get the folder with the sacred dew lines that nobody has. I got these in Toronto at St. Mike's Library in the late 70s, 77, 78. I wasn't a student or anything. I didn't know what the rules were to have access to this stuff. They had a real strict battle axe woman running the access to the special stacks. So I have to walk in, say who I was, and this and that, look sober, and she would look at me nervously, askance. Well, I don't know who this guy is. I don't see him around. And so she let me have one. So I go into the Xerox room, which is in her view. And if she's smart, she said, this fucking guy, he doesn't read them. He goes over and Xeroxes them. This fucking guy is stealing them. And I figured she'd stop me. She'd stop me at some point. She never did. I'd come in there once a week and get the next one. You know, I did this spread out over many weeks, not being too greedy. And I eventually got them all Xeroxed. Well, somewhere near the end of that, it's a Monday night seminar, and it's over, and McClone's talking to somebody. So I go over and stand by McClone to see what he's saying to this person. And he suddenly looks at me, and he says, Mrs. McGillicuddy tells me that you've been making visits at my archive. You know, he says her name, whatever it is. And he's taller than me. He's looking down at me with his imperious look. He says, so Mrs. Langtry says that you've been looking at the dew line. I said, yep. Confidently, he said, yep. And he nods. I don't know what he's thinking or if that's an issue. And, oh, yeah, that I had probably said something about that I dropped Mrs. Stewart's name, the secretary, that I was able to I'm allowed to see them because Mrs. Stewart said they're over here. And so it sounded like I was a student. So she probably checked to see I was a student or something registered, and I wasn't. So in that moment, McClellan looks at me. And he knows me, but he's wondering, I'm the only guy gathering up all this stuff in 77, 78. Nobody else gives a fuck about McClellan anymore. And I've got the bibliography from his secretary, and I'm going to all the libraries. There's 10 or so around Toronto, and I'm finding all these great articles, this obscure stuff. And he looked at me, and he sized me up, and I don't recall him saying much after that. He just looked at me, and I said, yep, that's what I'm doing. And then he looked away and started talking to somebody. So I passed the test. So I got the stuff. And so I went home and started reading them and making these brief notes. Like, in July 68, you have Newton versus Leibniz. That's a heavy Lin and LaRouche dialectic. So it's interesting that McLuhan was aware of this battle between the continental philosophers versus the British intelligence. In Newton's time, the Royal Society. So, as I go through my notes here, there's a book called The Parable of the Beast. Some guy, John N. Bleibtreu, it says, man's vital but alienated relationship to his animal self, a brilliant, far-ranging study. I wonder if I should, once I start reading this, I'm going to put everybody on mute. They may every now and then ask you, what do you have to say? So, The Parable of the Beast, subtitled Man's Vital but Alienated Relationship to His Animal Self, a brilliant, far-ranging study. As a quote from Alan Watts, fascinating. And then a quote from Marshall McLuhan, extremely relevant. So then, which is an odd thing that McLuhan would say, the longer versions of the quotes inside, Alan Watts says, and remember, this is when Alan Watts is scoping out McLuhan and McLuhan's scoping out Watts. And Watts says, I found the parable of the beast so fascinating that it wholly disrupted a day's work. The cumulative effect of all the experiments with animals described here so clearly and interestingly is to give detailed and factual testimony to all that. Is to give detailed and factual testimony to all that I and many others have been saying about man's impoverished relationship to his environment. Then it has McLuhan saying, This book takes full account of the new implosion of knowledge and the resulting interfaces among all disciplines and all images or probes. I'm going to make full use of it in my own work. And so he sees it as a subset of Finnegan's Wake. He imposes his own pattern on it. Full account of the new implosion of knowledge and the resulting interfaces among all disciplines and all images or probes. Who's blind? John Bleibtreu. He lives in Big Sur, California, and is currently at work on a new book dealing with mental illness. So I think there's a bit of a put on in McLuhan's review. So you turn the parable of the beast. Oop, you guys still there? I heard a click.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I have the parable of the beast just before the first July issue, 68 issue of the Dewline. But fortunately, right before the first Dewline is a Newsweek magazine article on this newsletter, so we can read it. We can see what Newsweek said on July 15th, 1968. Now, this is the hot summer. Martin Luther King has been shot, killed. Robert Kennedy's been killed. The Democratic Convention is going to happen in August. Big riots there in Chicago. Russia has invaded, Soviet Union has invaded Czechoslovakia in August. It's a time of turmoil, and the satellite news is incorporated that year. That's when news agencies can use the satellites to get live reports around the world. So it's a live global theater in this summer. So the article says, titled Marketing the Message. Let me put you on mute because it could be sounds. This is going to be for the record. What's his name? Ed will probably make a series out of this, so let's make sure it's all quiet all the time. So I will come back to you after I read most of this article. Mute all.
All participants are now
so,
muted.
So Marketing the Message, July 15, 1968, Newsweek magazine. So many media men trekked to Toronto to consult communications oracle Marshall McLuhan that he considered charging $200 for some of his more Delphic pronouncements on the world. Now McLuhan has found a more business-like medium for his messages. This week, some 1,000 initial subscribers who pay $50 a year will start to receive the first monthly issue of the McLuhan Dewline, which bills itself as a, quote, startling, shocking, early warning system for our era of instant change, unquote. Now, the Dewline is an actual electronic satellite something set up that the Pentagon put in the Arctic area across northern Canada to warn of any nuclear missiles or attacks coming from the Soviet Union. So it's an important defense early warning system. So McLuhan uses the DEW, which is David Eugene Worcester. That's what we used to say back then. But it's distant early warning system, or Dewline. So then it says, The 57-year-old McLuhan, who will return to the University of Toronto's Center for Culture and Technology in August, writes the newsletter himself. Now, they're talking about he's been at Fordham in 68, when a lot of the Tony Schwartz recordings were made. Eugene Schwartz, 41, a New York mail-order house executive, then prints and distributes it through a new firm he has set up called the Human Development Corporation. McLuhan, they quote McLuhan, "This letter is being aimed at the business community," says McLuhan. "We will deal with the invisible environment, the emperor's new clothes, completely invisible except to the little Peter Pans who do not suffer from hardening of the categories," unquote. McLuhan, in short, is going to try to retrain executives to experience the new electronic environment the way the young post-print generation does. He will try, for example, to get adults to, quote, feel television as children do rather than see it. Then the next section is called Primal. And it says, McLuhan's first newsletter, simply a four-page sheet, is visually pedestrian. It attempts to fit breaking news, violence, racial strife, student uprisings into the McLuhan worldview. Then it quotes McLuhan, "When this TV generation arrives at the job plateau in the next 3 to 4 years, it will abolish all of the old hardware. The Columbia students," which would have happened a few months earlier, "the Columbia students strike. The Columbia students are a mild foretaste of the drive toward primal, integral inwardness." Now, that is predicting the new age stuff of the 70s. at least they were doing it with a visual bias, but they thought they were moving towards primal integral awareness, unquote. In future issues, McLuhan will look at politics. One of the latest McLuhan predictions, neither of the two present front-running presidential candidates will be nominated by the conventions next month. Who would be the leading contenders? Nixon versus Humphrey, Hubert Humphrey. As far as I know, they both were leading and they remained leading. So McLuhan may be wrong on that point. So then it says, McLuhan seems to have found the right medium to reach businessmen. In the past few years, the newsletter business has grown so rapidly that there are now somewhere between 1,500 and 3,000 newsletters crisscrossing the country. They range from the 45-year-old weekly Kiplinger Washington Letter, which offers, quote, inside, unquote, business and political information, to the Mongolia Society Bulletin out of Bloomington, Indiana, which is devoted to, quote, promoting and furthering the study of Mongolia, its history, language, and culture, unquote. Then the next section is called HIGH, H-I-G-H. Lately, the most popular newsletters are those that sell technical information that businessmen can quickly translate into profits. They attempt to predict trends, highlight useful information, and save readers the time of plowing through thick journals and reports. The price for such service often runs high. Composition Information Services, a Los Angeles firm, charges $120 a year for biweekly newsletters that examine such fields as electronic developments in newspaper composing rooms. Electronic developments in newspaper composing rooms. Composition Information Services, says publisher Arthur Gardner, quote, is a new kind of information utility designed to provide craft-oriented people with a link to the new technology, unquote. And then in brackets, some parsimonious readers have turned the new technology against CIS. Instead of subscribing, they borrow copies from other firms and Xerox them. And that's the end of the bracket. So then it goes on. Many newsletters are started by former newsmen who spot useful information too specialized to be reported by the mass media. Arthur Cranish, a former Washington wire serviceman, started the weekly Washington Science Trends 10 years ago with $2,000 and half an office in the National Press Building. Quote, the government was sponsoring a great deal of work, says Cranish, and the information was being lost because no one was reporting it, unquote. Cranish keeps track of where U.S. grants and contracts are going and sells the information to industry, universities, and even back to the government itself. He now has a staff of reporters and two more newsletters. And it says, for all, not all newsletters are successful. And it quotes Lou Rothschild, president of the Independent Newsletters Association in Washington. He says, the mortality rate is rather high, says Lou Rothschild. He's president of the Independent Newsletter Association in Washington, which, among other things, lobbies to get newsletters. I can't make out what it says. Lobbies to get newsletters noticed, I guess. Quote, journalists often do not make something towards the businessman, he adds. My Xerox is a bit blurry there on the edge. Journalists often do not basically target businessmen, he adds. Even good businessmen can fail. Even good businessmen can fail. Early this year, Knowles Communication Incorporated, in brackets Look, Family Circle, and Venture Magazine, closed down its offices of the old Insider's newsletter because of postal rates had risen too high to make the newsletter economical. Generally, however, newsletters have proved so successful that they have spawned an entire new industry with its own problems and its own something. Rewards and vice. Philip Farish, 48, who publishes three commercial newsletters in Chicago, hit upon the obvious solution. The monthly newsletter on newsletters, which he sells for $28 a year to the publishers of other newsletters. So I will unmute.
All participants are now unmuted.
And this guy starts a newsletter on newsletters.
Yeah.
So with the information overload, gathering information for people becomes a business.
Yes.
It's like a service.
I like that McLuhan was awarded he was the new oracle that he was showing the occult,
the new secrets. Right,
yeah.
The new emperor's clothes. Yeah. So many media men, you know, when his secretary, Mark Stewart, broke her hip in May 78, and that's how I knew her before, but that's how we became close friends, because Carolyn became an advisor to her medical problems. So we would be invited up to her cottage in the summer and that, and then she'd tell me all the interesting stuff about working with McLuhan. But she never got healed, never got, cured. Aged people, when they break their hips, that's serious. And she just didn't have the nutrition or whatever to heal. And Carolyn was, what was Carolyn doing? She was interning at McGill, so she wasn't a doctor yet. So I don't know what she told her, but it didn't help Marg. She remained crippled for the next 20 years till she died. She had to sit around all the time. She could walk, but she had to sit. So what was I going to say about that?
About the occult?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. So when she was in the hospital, McLuhan sent her a big pizza. Okay, so this person's laid up, a serious injury. She gets a pizza from McLuhan. What's it say on the pizza? Can you predict? It says the medium is the message.
Shut up.
Yeah. And I think there's another one, another a second one she got, and he called it on the pizza. It said, "Here's mud in your eye." So he had a not normal sense of humor.
Yeah.
That meant the medium is a message applied to any situation. He applied it to everybody, to every scene. So what the medium is the message, does that mean that eating the pizza is the form of the pizza, not the content? I don't know how that fits. Or the medium is the message, the hospital she's in, the recuperation, what's the medium?
Was the medium is the message spelled out like with olives or something, or was it written on the box?
I think I'm not sure about that, but it was spelled out somehow.
Well, that's an important detail, though, because if it was written on the box.
Well, I've solved it. I quickly traveled there, and I'm back already, and I'm telling
you
that it was written on the pizza, okay? It's on the pizza.
Those are also McLuhan's initials. MM, the medium is
that's
MS.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. What do I say? I told people last couple weeks ago that Jim has on his Winnipeg School of Mediacology or the Toronto School of Perception a excerpt from a book, a rare book, which did you remember? I don't know if you listened to CBC, Chad. There was a guy named Danny Finkelman. He used to do interviews on Saturday morning. Had a radio show.
No.
You ever hear of that guy? Danny
No.
Finkelman? So he put out a book of his memoirs or something, and there's the transcription of him interviewing McLuhan and Tom Easterbrook, who were college buddies in Winnipeg. They grew up together. And Easterbrook went on to become a disciple of Harold Innes. And he was a member of the explorations team. So he and McLuhan remained buddies all their life. And they're both interviewed on CBC. So McLuhan is describing the life of a Winnipeg person or a Western Prairie guy, and he's using all the way he describes a post-literate or pre-literate person, has total vision, has no point of view, blah, 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 and all the non-visual space characteristics. So here is McLuhan describing himself as a Winnipegian with all these non-literate, pre-literate, post-literate qualities. And he's describing the literate man, the Torontonians, as visually spaced, visual biased people, the people on Eastern Canada. So you realize that the whole, and I just saw this a couple weeks ago, I never saw this before, all that McLuhan's writing, like the medium is a message, his own initials, is a very personal poem to himself, about himself. I versus ear means a Winnipegian versus a Torontonian. That's the multi-level of his poem, or his creativity. Like Finney's Wake, there's autobiographical elements in Finney's Wake, you know, here and there.
Right. Yeah.
Like so, Egan said, memories are mummeries. So
yes.
Memories were his mummers.
That's right. Now, in this period, this summer in 68, 69, they're making the Dewline news, the, I think it was called the Dewline cards, right? He made a pack of 52 cards, each one with an aphorism on it. What were they called? The Dewline cards? Something like that. And that was one of them. One of them had the phrase, thanks for the mammaries. M-A-M-M-A-R-I-E-S. That was, see, businessmen were supposed to, yeah, he made it for the Dewline. So eventually, during one of the Dewlines over the next few years, he makes a card deck for the businessmen to dole out to each other these cards and then be inspired by the aphorisms and stimulate conversation and new perceptions. And one of them was called Thanks for the Mammaries. Another great one is, I have a small brain and I intend to use it. That's a good one. I hear no laughter, though. Where's the laughter?
Well, that's early 70s humor.
Yes,
at least
late
10% of the brain.
Yes. If I only get 10%, I'm going to use it.
Well, it sounds like I read that book that DeKirchhoff did with Mark Fetterman, the McLuhan for Managers or whatever.
Yeah.
It sounds like they were kind of retrieving what he did, what McLuhan did back in those days, trying to give businessmen some things to just interrupt their patterns.
Right. Yeah, that's what Mark and Derek tried to do. And they got hassled by Mady Molinaro and Mrs. McLuhan. They didn't like anybody using Marshall stuff for books like that, and they had serious restrictions or something made on them. Janie Marchessault did a book on McLuhan, made $1,000 or something from it. She's a professor at York University, and she told me as soon as the book came out, she got called down to Mrs. McLuhan and Mady Molinaro being McLuhan's literary agent, and they grilled her about, how can you do this? You didn't ask for credits, blah, blah, blah. It really hassled her. And they said, we want all 50% of the profits. And she said, well, the book made $1,000, okay? So she was quite shocked at the McLuhan management, you know, interfering with her right to be a person and write a book on McLuhan and not have to pay a blackmail to them. Something like that. It really shocked her that this. And she said, my book's not going to make any money, and yet they wanted to police it somehow. Well, who knows? Maybe it would have made a lot of money if she was lucky. So here it is, the first one. It's a simple page. It says the McLuhan Dewline, capital D. Oh, I better mute you animals. Okay.
All participants are now muted.
So the McLuhan Dewline, capital D, capital E, capital W, dash, capital L, capital I, capital N, capital E, Dewline. And then underneath it says, a startling, shocking early warning system for our era of instant change. Isn't that what Newsweek had? Yeah, Newsweek just quoted he said, the Dewline bills itself as that. Okay. So, July 1968. So it says, main probe here. And there's a column that goes one, two, three, four pages. So sort of center and to the left is big print column. Then on the far right is a smaller column, and it says side probes here, and there are smaller print. There are six of those. So we got two, a dialogue of a big column, and then a column juxtaposed beside it of smaller items. So let's see what would he say to people. Main probe here. Black is not a color. In brackets, white is all colors at once. The Negro question is a red herring. The Negro question is a problem only for literate, civilized men. A blind Negro girl once said to me, quote, wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody were blind? Then there would be no race problem, unquote. McClune says, she was wrong. Let us see why. Then a colon. So then he says, literate visual man, or a Trontonian, if there's a hidden agenda, the Trontonian, okay, literate visual man lives by classification and detached bureaucratic indifference. Literacy creates the organization man and the hardware services of advanced countries. So then it has footnote one. So we will have to read the side probe, are the footnotes. So the footnotes are not at the bottom of the page. This is the first radical change of typographic cliches. The footnotes are on the side of the page. So footnote one says, in dark letters, on the real communism of our times, and communism is in quotes. So that's in dark letters. Then in lighter letters it says, literacy via printing produces hardware. Gutenberg fathered all assembly lines. By 1840, for example, England had developed many hardware environmental services such as book, press, rail, post, highways, markets, and mechanical industry to the point of virtual communism. Virtual, I don't know that word, virtual communism in quotes. In other words, the hardware services available to the ordinary person were far beyond the means of the greatest wealth to provide for itself. Marx came later. The Communist Manifesto was written in 1848. Like Edward Bellamy, Marx was looking backward, not forward. All utopias, from Plato's Republic to Orwell's 1984, are rearview mirror images. Marx was thus aware of the tribal communism of primitive peoples, but not of the new communism of his own environment. So that's footnote one. Now, back to the main column. Phonetic literacy is the only detribalizing technology known to man. But radio, talkies, and TV, on the other hand, do not create this detachment, classification, and civilization. Instead, they create software information environments. They create total involvement and tribalism. In brackets, tribal man lives by ear, by involvement. The German word for cloud, in quotes, is Volk, V-O-L-K, in quotes, dash, the tribe, the all-enveloping group dream. End of bracket. This image of the family group and corporate consciousness evokes total participation. Now, 2,500 years of literate hardware service and organization of civilized, specialized man are encountering the electric extension of our own nervous system, in brackets, the new software service environments, end of bracket. The predictable dynamics of this encounter of the old hardware and the new software is manifest in every phase of our lives today. Footnote 2, in black letters, footnote 2, on the tribalizing effect of the new software environment on the literate sectors of our society. In a smaller print, it says, at the same time that the Negro is being asked to detribalize and allow himself to be drawn into our centralized society, the new electric speed of information movement is resulting in a kind of decentralization, and that's italicized, a kind of decentralization of that society as a whole. Two articles in the New York Times from May 28, 1968 point up this irony. The first is apropos of the switch from 4 to 36 phone books in London. Then there's an article from the New York Times, London, May 27th. It says, in London, a phone book crisis. In the substance of the article, it says, the books are the four telephone directories of use in the London area. Word leaked out a few days ago that the government planned to replace the four with 36 neighborhood directories. This alone might not have caused the public uproar that followed, except for one fact. The government said that residents would get only the slim directory covering their own neighborhood. The assumption apparently was that persons in one neighborhood of London never called persons in another neighborhood. So he says, he gives that article, and he says, once again, it is this kind of decentralization into tribal pockets that results from electric speed of information movement. In brackets, New York City is one extreme example of such tribal nucleation of spatial arrangement. The global village is another. End of bracket. The editorial page of the same paper, New York Times, carried an essay on the, quote, decentralization shambles, unquote. It began, quote, the worst failure of the state legislature in the disastrous session just ended was on the critical issue of school decentralization. The lawmakers caved in ignominiously under the irresponsible pressures of vested interest groups led by the United Federation of Teachers. Brushed aside were the carefully considered proposals of expert investigators and the precise prescriptions of the state's own education authorities. What emerged instead was a watered-down version that bordered on a mandate for inaction. foot dragging on, continuing the article, foot dragging on decentralization involves a flirtation with disaster. It would sabotage the reform of the education of all children. Conditions would be aggravated with attendant chaos in the predominantly Negro areas. Unquote. Now, this is during the period in 67, 68, when there were a lot of Negro riots in the cities. Black power was not a big deal yet, so they're still using the word Negro. And in the summer of 68, well, after Martin Luther King got shot in April, there were riots. So it was a tough time for the racial situation, and that's what his first topic is for the first do line. So it's a hot summer. So you have that quote, that second article in the New York Times, and then McLuhan says, the United Federation of Teachers is a typically centralized and literate organization, now incompatible with the new software environment and the new identity image fostered by that software. So that was footnote two. So back to the main column. Today, for example, the non-literate backward countries and the non-literate individuals within their own society, such as the Negro, get the new software technology before they get the old hardware of the 19th century. Nigeria and Tanzania get radio before motor cars or ice boxes. The American Negro got TV before he got cars or cornflakes. That software creates in the Orient or in Mississippi a billion-dollar service environment. A Barinicide feast, that's B-A-R-I-N-E-C-I-D-E, I guess that's from Roman history or something. A Barinicide feast of inviting goodies before there's anything to eat. So they get the radio before there's cornflakes. This is the gripe of the Columbia students as much as the kids in Watts, California, in the ghetto. So the Watts riots happened in August 65, 3 years before. The American TV child, in brackets, Negro and white alike, wallows in a software environment of images, capital I for images, before he acquires a literacy that relates him to the producer-consumer hardware. The TV generation is thus naturally a Peter Pan generation of mystics that sees, quote, maturity, unquote, and responsibilities as linked to a ruthless and archaic hardware. And there's footnote three. Footnote three in black letters. On the new, quote, Peter Pan generation, unquote, and its link to violence. Aldous Huxley was quite on the beam when he observed of Hitler. So then there's this long quotation where, I don't know where it's from. It's like a novel. It's somebody's dialoguing, a guy named Murugan and a Dr. Robert. So let's see. Also, someone said, "Will it might be between Dr. Murugan and Dr. Will Murugan and Dr. Robert?" It's, so I don't know who starts. Oh, let's see. I'm trying to think. Said Will. So Will Murugan says, "What about girl Peter Pans?" Dr. Robert says, "They're very rare, but the boys are as common as blackberries. You can expect one Peter Pan among every five or six male children." Among problem children, among the boys who can't read, won't learn, don't get on with anyone, and finally turn to the more violent forms of delinquency, 7 out of 10 turn out, if you take an x-ray of the bones of the wrists, to be Peter Pans. The rest are mostly muscle people of one sort or another. So this was maybe, Aldous Huxley dies in 1963. He dies on the day JFK is assassinated, and Huxley took LSD on that day and died while going through LSD, whatever he went through. So this is 5 years later. So this may be some novel written in the 40s or 30s or something. But it does mention Hitler, so maybe it's in the 50s. So so they're saying that the Peter Pans tend to have the bones, certain small bones. So Will says, I'm trying to think of a good historical example of a delinquent Peter Pan. Dr. Robert says, you don't have to go far afield. The most recent, as well as the best and biggest, was Adolf Hitler. Hitler, says Murugan. Murugan's tone was one of shocked astonishment. Hitler was evidently one of his heroes. Dr. Robert said, read the Führer's biography, said Dr. Robert. A Peter Pan, if ever there was one, hopeless at school, incapable either of competing or cooperating, envying all the normally successful boys, and because he envied them, hating them, and to make himself feel better, despising them as inferior human beings. Then came the time for puberty, but Adolf was sexually backward. Other boys made advances to girls, and the girls responded. Adolf was too shy, too uncertain of his manhood. unquote. So that's a Peter Pan, and he McLuhan's calling the hippies Peter Pans. Now, McLuhan was a rugged guy. He liked tough businessmen, and he was an athlete himself, so maybe he's implying that they were gay. I'm not sure. But anyways, that's footnote 3 to the Peter Pan generation of mystics that sees maturity and responsibilities as linked to a ruthless and archaic hardware. Then McLuhan in the main column, that was quoting from the main column, and we continue. When this TV generation arrives at the job plateau in the next 3 to 4 years, it will abolish all of the old hardware. The Columbia students are a mild foretaste of the drive towards primal, integral inwardness. That is why the Negro question is a red herring. To the post-literate TV generation, there are no Negroes. There are only people. The detribalized American Negro will find an overwhelming ally in the younger portion of the retribalized American middle class. Now, this is also when soul, Aretha Franklin, is getting on the cover of Time magazine. Soul music has taken over as an antidote or parallel to this Jefferson Airplane stuff, which maybe doesn't become big till 69, though I'm not sure. Woodstock happens in 69. And you've got the soul of Aretha Franklin and still the British invasion still going on. The immediate dilemma of the American Negro is the need to acquire literacy in order to find a job in quotes, in the old hardware service environment. But to get literate and to detribalize and specialize himself just when the white society is retribalizing is a debilitating irony, in brackets, an irony felt by all white teenagers too, end of bracket. Or close bracket. As for the Negro himself, he is now confronting semi-literate unions and politicians whose scant visual culture gives them a frantic grip on the antiquated hardware and the specialized skills and classifications of the pre-TV age. The danger of civil war will come from these ethnically dominated unions for whom literacy and its hardware technology is still a novelty, still status symbols, still marks of achievement. So here's McLuhan predicting civil war between the hard hats and the blacks. Or the Negro. The old visual world of literacy could tolerate such collision of multitudes of private points of view because of the certitude that these collisions took place within a permanently fixed frame. The collisions engendered by a ballot box guaranteed a faithful image of the general will. Monadology, or monads, could go no further. Radio ended the efficacy of the ballot box as it ended melodic structure. Even when radio was new in the 1920s, it erased the old identity of groups and individuals alike. So then we go to footnote 4. Footnote 4 is, in black letters, on the bass-ackwardness of human progress. That's bassackwardness. On the bass-ackwardness, or back-asswardness, on the bass-ackwardness of human progress, progress in quotes, and in smaller print. The first radio broadcast, in quotes broadcast, in the world occurred from the Dublin Post Office in 1916. The anti-British rebels tinkered with an old ship-to-shore Navy radio until they put it into a diffusion pattern and proclaimed their new image to the world. At first, before this, radio had been used only as a substitute for the telegraph. The breakdown of this telegraph function yielded the breakthrough of broadcasting. In brackets, in a similar way, it was the breakdown, in quotes, of telegraph that led Edison accidentally to discover the telephone. He heard voices on the telegraph wire and set out to correct this defect. Thus is born bass-ackwards progress. Okay, next part in the main column. It was the American Negro, in fact, who made the only creative response to the new software environment of radio. In brackets, the English Limey or Slum Kids, dash the Beatles, dash, made the only creative response to TV. Close bracket. The New Orleans Negroes merged traditional hymns and English speech rhythms to create a syncopated new art form. In brackets, jazzer, J-A-S-E-R, in quotes, New Orleans French for to yatter, Y-A-T-T-E-R. So jazzer, jazz comes from J-A-S-E-R, meaning to yatter. Okay, so there's a footnote 5, but I'm going to take a break here and unmute. See.
All participants are now unmuted.
Anything to say, anybody?
It's a large span he's covering in this part.
Yes.
Very large. Regarding
well, he's
touches.
Go ahead.
Wait,
Roxy, hold it. I want to respond to Bert. Large vista landscape. Well,
yes.
McLuhan is being the satellite conductor. He's floating around the planet, and he's talking about whole continental trends. It's the satellite view, which is the hidden environment.
He's talking about the wolke, the cloud. So he says it's an environment that demands total involvement, total participation, and we are now in the cloud, the total.
Right. Good point. The Android meme rips off McLuhan and ends up calling itself the cloud.
Yes.
The Android meme is the second phase of technologies extending itself. So, like my chart,
demands,
go to the best. Go ahead.
Mass involvement.
Mass involvement.
Talking back.
What? Throw them back?
Demands talking back.
Yes, yes. The mass man is talking back to Marshall. And like my chart shows, the Android meme goes to the best sources to rip off stuff, even though the people don't know these sources. Okay, so, Chad, do you have anything to say? Where's Chad? Oh, Chad's not. Oh, no, Chad's here. Unmute. Corbin, do you have anything to say, Corbin?
Hello.
You're saying no, Corbin? Nothing to say. Okay, so much of what we're reading here is in Understanding Media and in articles that he was writing in the 64 to 68 period. It's not really new, but there are particulars that are new, like the new news stories, the new articles. He's taking news stories and applying his formula to the new trends. So the American Negro was the only creative response to the new software environment radio, and the Beatles were the only creative response to TV. So you have nothing to say, Chad? Okay. So I will now.
Bob
continue.
Wants a break, so I'm going to give him a break.
Oh, yeah. Have you? Okay, we've covered a lot of stuff, and do you want to maybe not read as much and take more interactive talk?
No, it's fine, Bob. I mean, I find it's fine because it's pretty diverse what you're covering with the different columns, the large column and then the footnotes. So it's...
You're also commenting from what you know, so it's no problem.
Right. Is it interesting?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, he's saying this, and people, they don't know that they're living in a software communist environment. You know, they're not thinking that way. But he's throwing that idea at these people, at the businessmen. So we just read the section where the New Orleans Negroes merged traditional hymns and English speech rhythms to create a syncopated new art form. In brackets, jazzé, New Orleans French for to yatter. Then it says footnote 5. And in big dark letters, on the tactile and I got to mute you guys. It also creates an echo here, so it's another reason to do it.
All participants are now muted.
So, on the tactile and discontinuous nature of jazz, dash, and the modern world to which it adapts. So jazz adapts to the radio world. Or jazz is music adapting to the new rhythms. Jazz is based on discontinuity, not on connection. On the tactile space of the interval, not on the visual continuum of the melody. In brackets, melody hodos, H-O-D-O-S. I guess that's... Latin or something, for the song road, melody hodos, the song road. So there's a visual continuum to melody. Then he says, jazz was, in spatial terms, the mosaic of the telegraph press, as much as the cubist multifaceted world of Picasso. In brackets, when Le Corbusier first saw New York, he said, quote, it is le jazz hot en pierre, which is translated into it is hot jazz in stone, unquote. End of bracket. Then Zappa says, no, LaRouche, no, Arthur Coker, no, Bob, no. H. McLuhan says, the syncopated and discontinuous character of jazz has been as much misunderstood as Finnegan's Wake. So he's always going to bring in Finnegan's Wake. Touch or contact does not create continuity or connectedness. Quite the reverse. It creates the interval, as beat creates rhythm. In brackets, the Japanese housewife never reproves her husband. She rearranges the spaces between flowers to express her, quote, blues, unquote. Close bracket. This is in direct contrast with the effect of the old literate visual environment, which creates the illusion of an absolute, in quotes, continuous, rational, unquote, space as a cosmic fact. Read that again. This is in direct contrast with the effect of the old literate visual environment, which creates the illusion of an absolute, continuous, rational space as a cosmic fact. In the May 1968 issue of the Scientific American, Frederick C. Creeling contrasts the world of Leibniz and of Newton. The world of Leibniz, inspired by Plato, that's in quote, assumed the changing nature of true reality, unquote. And the article says, what is important to realize is that to Leibniz, Newton's theory seemed a regression to medieval notions that had been dispelled with great effort, unquote. Then McLuhan says, for those who had come to see every force as the effect of the emotion, do that again, for those who had come to see every force as the effect of the motion of material particles, they admitted of no way for bodies to affect one another except through the force of impact exerted when they came into contact. Actually, that's not McLuhan. I'm not sure. It has a quote at the end. So, Newton's theory seemed a regression to medieval notions that had been dispelled with great effort. For, let's assume this is the article, for those who had come to see every force as the effect of the motion of material particles, they admitted of no way for bodies to affect one another except through the force of impact exerted when they came into contact. In other words, it had to be kinetic pressure, kinetic rubbing up against each other for anything to be moved. And, you know, and McLuhan is saying there's a tactile interplay which is not involving contact. So then McLuhan says, the invisible pull of gravitational environment was incompatible with this view of change. Today, the Leibnizians are those who think it is the content of media when it contacts a viewer or recipient that causes change. So the Leibnizians are those who think it is the content of media when it contacts a viewer or recipient that causes change. The Newtonians see the media themselves as exerting gravitational pull or change upon the perceptions. So that's pretty interesting. LaRouche is a Leibnizian, Platonist, against the Aristotelian medieval Newton. But McLuhan is siding with, well, maybe he's not taking sides, but he's saying the one who sees the invisible ground is a Newtonian, where the Leibnizians see the content of media, and they think that kinetic contact is what causes change. So that's pretty interesting. So we're at, where were we? That was footnote 5. Now, back to McLuhan talking about jazz in the main column. Jazz was accepted at once in all the world capitals and still reigns in Tokyo, Berlin, Paris, and New York. Thus, the American Negro integrated the world while a few whites pondered the need to, quote, integrate, unquote, white and black. Jazz was a tribal acoustic response adjusted to the global village created by radio. With this new medium, the tribal image returned in show business and in politics alike. The new showman in both, politics and business, had to put on, that's in quotes, put on his audience and become a corporate image, like Mussolini or Hitler or FDR, that's Roosevelt, or Jack Kennedy. These men were therefore tribal chieftains or emperors on a scale unknown before in the world. Now, he says Mussolini, Hitler, FDR, and Jack Kennedy. These men were quite blind, however, to their new environment. All environments are imperceptible to their inhabitants, as water is to a fish. That is why, as Trevor Roper observes, so there's a long quote by this historian, Trevor Roper, quote, any society, as long as it is or feels itself to be a working society, tends to invest in itself. A military society tends to become more military, a bureaucratic society more bureaucratic, a commercial society more commercial. As the status and profits of war or office or commerce are enhanced by success, and institutions are framed to forward it. Therefore, when such a society is hit by a general crisis, it finds itself partially paralyzed by the structured weight of increased social investment. The dominant military or official or commercial classes cannot easily change their orientation, and their social dominance and the institutions through which it is exercised prevent other classes from securing power or changing policy, unquote. So he says the new environments, he's having this long quote to illustrate that the environments are invisible to the fish. And McLuhan says, the matter of Negro violence, therefore, is no different from any other kind of violence, psychic or social, private or corporate, military, commercial, or educational. In brackets, even the kingdom of heaven can only be entered by violence, i.e., violence to our mundane image or identity. Close quote. Close bracket. Wherever a gap or interval occurs, there's an area of new friction, ferment, interface, and change. Thus, all violence is making, not matching. And we come to footnote 6 in dark letters on making, not matching, as a form of adjusting to reality. So then McLuhan with smaller print says, the Newtonians, not to mention Planck, Max Planck, Einstein, or Heisenberg, close bracket, the Newtonians were more aware of the bias and physical distortion introduced into all frameworks by the mere act of perception. They knew that seeing was making, not matching. Artistic representation by matching, for example, was as much a product of literacy as representative government. And a footnote 6. So that was a footnote 2. Thus, all violence is making, not matching. Now, he's implying that the tribal people, the hippies, are very violent. And this is in around the time of the Summer of Love. But he's saying, no, they're makers, so they're violent. He says, violence has no target or goal so much as the creation of a new image, as in an ad campaign in quotes. The Negro has no target or goal in his violence. Just as when he created jazz, he had no goals beyond making a form of participation and involvement. Then he quotes the famous British novelist Joseph Conrad. It is above all that you may see. So Joseph Conrad, in summing up his work, said, it is above all... let me do that again. C is underlined in italics. So Conrad said, it is above all, meaning the purpose of his writing, it is above all that you may see, in quotes. McLuhan used to quote that here and there. Then McLuhan ends by saying, the violence is a probe of the contours of reality, much as new media, like new biological species, create new dimensions of space and time. End of the first newsletter. At the bottom, Human Development Corporation, 119 Fifth Avenue. There's Bob's number, 19. New York, New York, 10003. Three take away one is two. Carpenter, 1968, Marsh McLuhan. So, that is everything.
All participants are now unmuted.
Unmuted. We're ready to hear your insights and probes.
Well, I was thinking about the jazz, how the musical environment creates the tribe, because it's something in which everybody can get involved beyond their race.
Right. Right.
And,
beyond the visuals.
Yes, and he's talking about the resonant interval, and Ian talks about the resonant tonality. So I was thinking, what would be the difference between that, the interval?
There's no interval.
Acoustic space.
I would maybe have some interesting things to say, like we would never agree with Marsh McLuhan, but there is agreement overlap. The way Ion talks about he uses the word tactility, the way he talks about the interplay and the Hendiades, these are variations of tactility. And Ion is saying that visually biased science is limited, just as McLuhan is. So there's much anticipation of Ion's new insights to most people, by McLuhan.
Yes, for me it's funny that Ion says we don't agree with McLuhan, but I see a lot of correspondence between things that McLuhan is talking about and Ion.
Yes, in the world of Mortar, McLuhan is as much the same as Ion, but in the private awareness of the individual God, you know, McLuhan is not relevant on first introduction. It's too much talk about outer world, outer kingdom. It's not telling you, McLuhan's not telling you, McLuhan's almost telling you, this meaty world's bigger than you, you're just a little man, and any of your stupid agendas are puny, even if you, are looking for civil rights. They're puny compared to these new environments. So he's actually promoting little man-ness. But he's doing it as all these little men's running around vain and pissed off at this and that and only noticing the content in the view mirror. So he's satirizing little man. So little man, who's concerned about what's bugging him, it's bigger than him. And McLuhan says, well, what you think is bigger than you is puny compared to what's really bigger than you. So then that might calm down the person. Then the person starts to get a different perspective on things, and then that would lead to the autonomy that McLuhan is leading people and pushing towards. He is trying to make the little man stop being a little man, but it requires a lot of perception of ideas about what the environment is so that the little man knows what the issues are.
You said at the end all his writing was about seeing or making things visible?
Yeah, to see in italics. Now that's Joseph Conrad, and that doesn't mean to see visually. That means tactile, comprehensive seeing. In other words, to understand or to overlay. Maybe not so much overlay.
Yes, sir. I wanted to make this connection with the seeing as understanding or overlaying. That we actually see sometimes more by talking or by with language,
yes.
Like all these environments that are invisible are being made visible by talking, by talking about them or...
No, right, exactly. McLuhan said that language, speech, or interaction with the mouth and your body language is tactile. It's not oral, it's tactile. You're interfacing, you can smell the person, just all the senses are engaged. So speech, interacting conversation, it doesn't have to be literate speech, but the kind of full sensory engagement, which includes sound, is tactile, and we're gradually retrieving the most intimate caveman interaction in our media. We're eventually going to be talking to a robotoid of ourselves and engaging and talking, and it'll be a simulation. All technologies will have imploded and made this... clone, so to speak. And we'll return to the tactility of interpersonal communication, which is where we began, the Garden of Eden, say, in media terms. And we went through this whole phase of abstracting our ear and mouth, then abstracting our eye, and then abstracting our kinetic muscles, then abstracting our tactile central nervous system, all to eventually end up with you looking at a double of yourself and talking to it. So, yes, language is a way, talking is a way you see. You don't just use your eyes.
What you're saying, we end up talking to ourselves, is like connecting with you again,
Yeah, you and you.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a technical version of that. Now, there's probably the limitation of that is you end up just talking to yourself. Now, God only talks to himself. That's all there is. But the added benefit of putting on the false premise of time and interpersonal communication is the treat of being human. And I see Ion as promoting that part. Once everybody's a god, then there's communication. If you notice, Ion said to me yesterday that people, they don't believe in heaven. Then Ion makes them think, no, maybe there is a heaven. So they start desiring it. And what was the other one? People don't believe in RNA drops. No, they don't believe in ascension. And then that's, I think it was ascension. Then that's all they want, is to do that. And then they start trying to find out how to get there. And then Ayn says, Bob, it's your job to define where they're going to land. So that's a new task for people like that.
By communicating, we change our perception.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to talk to another god or goddess to see, let it mutate you, give you new impressions and images and ideas that would help you complete your knowing of everything. You have anything to say, Bert?
Yes. I found footnote 5 interesting. There was a discussion, he mentioned about the invisible pull of gravity, and then there was a comparison between the Newtonian view of media and the Leibniz, the content of the media, and it made me think of ion, because ion is told us, which is sort of a combination, that gravity is something that we created, but we're moving to the point now where gravity is not relevant in
right.
a new environment, in the new environment. So that struck out another sort of intuitiveness of McLuhan of doing this whole new environment, that he was putting things together in comparing the Newton and Leibniz of maybe other bigger things that are to come in the future.
Right. It's Leibniz, not Leibniz, Leibniz.
Leibniz, yes.
Yeah. Now, McLuhan says the poet, the seer, sees the invisible environment. So he's saying among scientists, as literally biased as they are, the Newtonians are closer to the poetic function of seeing the invisible environment, because Newton proposed there were these invisible forces from the moon that were pulling on us. That's gravity. So now, LaRouche, as a diehard Leibnizian, points out the disservice of Newton's thinking. And, you know, Newton, LaRouche would see this invisible stuff as a cult retrieval of Gnostic stuff, and that Plato was more realistic because Plato dealt with the invisible archetypes. But that's not, LaRouche doesn't see Plato that way. See, it's interesting, it's all muddled up. Newton deals with invisible environments, and he's an Aristotelian, and he's against Leibniz, who's a Platonist. But the Platonist deals with the invisible archetypes. So you can see that on the surface is a great pattern, but underneath, specialists and physicists would really quibble with McLuhan's definitions. They'd get really bogged down in the actual definitions of gravity and this and that, and they would reject McLuhan. But McLuhan is, as he says, writing cartoons, broad outlines that everybody can see themselves into, like broad boundaries and patterns. So when people started arguing with McLuhan, saying that's not true, he wasn't trying to be truthful. He was just using words to create patterns to get you out of your rut of hendiadies. So there's a subtle thing going on here.
I was thinking about the perception, because when I was a child, sometimes I would go to buy tortillas, because I like to go to the place they were making these tortillas. They were listening to the radio, to these stories. And I was thinking how you listen with your eyes, like this. These stories will make you see all these things.
Right.
Like very vivid.
Okay, let me respond to that. You don't have to listen with your eyes. Because radio extends the acoustic and the tactile, the audio tactile, the senses must compensate. So the visual sense is, holy shit, this is not a very visual situation. I better step up my visuality function here to balance off this acoustic stuff that's coming in. And that's why people, McLuhan said, like listening to stuff on the radio. They felt their imagination was activated. They didn't feel their imagination was activated by TV. But what they mean by imagination is the visual part of their literate mind. And they could play with it and work with it and visualize and compensate for the acoustic effect. So you like to hear the visual, you like to engage your visual senses as an acoustic person when you heard the radio. and listen to the stories. That make sense?
Yes.
Oh, Roxana, she fell off. Now she's back on. Okay. Roxana, you would enjoy these stories and storylines, right?
Yes, I was... I dropped off, so I just came back, I suppose.
Yes. No, so you may not heard what I said. Okay,
no.
I'm saying... Okay, well, you missed an important point. Radio is an extension of the odd owl, and all electric media are tactile. So the odd owl tactile. Now, it numbs the acoustic and the tactile, but the other senses scramble to compensate for the new tactile numbness or new odd owl tactile extension. So that's why literate people said they liked radio because they could use their imagination, their mind's eye. And so that's why McLuhan, on one level, called radio a hot medium. It had a literate effect because people would fill in and like filling in the eye bias to compensate for the acoustic perceptual impact. So you would like and go listen to stories being said, the content of the radio, of visual things that you can imaginate on. That's what I'm saying, that the media always cause a compensating reaction from the other senses.
Yes, and that's why would you say that the ultimate result would be synesthesia?
Yes, synesthesia, that may be a product of television. Because television, people say, well, there's no imagination. I'm just looking at this dumb situation comedy, and... I'm missing the mind's eye activity I get from listening to radio. So literate people like radio for those reasons, or they like the literate part of it, the stories, the ideas. The acoustic people liked the radio for music, for tribal involvement. And then the teenagers took it over when TV came in and obsolesced or moved the radio aside from its – before that, it was the main medium. So that's why you could say that all the nations around the world, which were built up with literate industry, once the radio environment came in the 30s, the 20s and 30s, it put all the literate boundaries of nations in question. And therefore you had paranoia. So Italy, you know, invades Africa to retrieve its visual boundaries that are being threatened by the imploded radio environment. Germany tries to retrieve the German tribal image and overcome what was that word? Claustrophobia, but forget what they what their term was. They had some term for feeling closed in. I think that even was the reason the Kaiser of World War I went to war. So this burst of national violence leads to World War II. The forging of a new identity because the visual boundaries are threatened by this membrane of global access called the radio, this implosion.
And what does McLuhan mean when he talks about synecdotic substitution? Is that this...
I didn't hear what the words were. You didn't say, it didn't come through clearly what he said.
Synecdotic substitution, like,
or
like repressing this medium or suppress for some time, like some people start fasting on social media or internet or...
Okay, you're saying that phrase, I've never seen McLuhan say it, he says jazz is syncopated, but you're saying synoptic? Or?
No, synecdoche.
Synecdoche.
Yeah.
That's a grammatical term. Have you seen him talk about synecdoche?
I saw somewhere, and I remember it was something about this suppression of some... media or something like that.
Yeah. And what it is, it's in Laws of Media. You have that book, Laws of Media, right?
Yes.
Yeah, at the end, he does a tetrad on metaphor, synecdoche, simile, and maybe irony. And it's very complicated. I'd have to get the book because metaphor is two figures and two grounds. He would talk about the shifting towards a matching metaphor versus a making metaphor. So synecdoche was more of a matching metaphor, two figure grounds. But it's complicated, and I'd have to go get the book and read them all out and explain them. So we're not going to do that. That's where you saw that. That he doesn't talk about it anywhere else other than Laws of Media.
Well, I'm looking for the word, and it says a figure of speech in which a part is used for the whole.
Yes. Have you? Are you looking it up in the Laws of Media?
No, I just Googled the word.
Yeah. It's like, what would be a part for a whole? So, stinky. I don't know. Let's say a person has a nickname, and a nickname refers to one particular part of the body. Maybe like jugs. Guys would call women with big breasts jugs. So that's a part. So I'd say jugs entered the room. That's a part that becomes representative of the whole person. You see? A part representing the whole. That's synecdoche. I forget what the ops of that is. Metonymy, maybe. Metonymy. I think that's metonymy, where the whole serves for the part. Are you seeing that? What's metonymy? Metonymy defined.
In the Wikipedia.
Yeah.
They say synecdoche, or I don't know how you say it.
Yeah, synecdoche.
It's a class of metonymy.
Yes. So, what's an example of? They're used all the time by us.
They give this example.
Okay.
Bread and butter is used for livelihood.
His livelihood? Bread and butter is his livelihood?
Yeah, for example.
Yes. Sort of like processes. Big processes are metonymy. I don't know, nicknames. The press. What would be? I don't know. I don't have. If you can come up with another example, there's better than that one. It's some kind of. It's like slang terms for institutions.
Is it like, for example, one part of something will be used to refer for a whole?
Well, that's how they define synecdoche. And metonymy is like that, but it's a bigger part. Just put in metonymy examples, and we'll come up with a better example.
They say it's a substitute for reduction.
I know, but don't they have examples?
They say, for example, fish tails will be an idea that can be used from taking things from the ocean.
Take Wall Street. I think that's an example, the phrase Wall Street. That's, represent a whole bunch of economic institutions. And you just sum it up with Wall Street. I think that's a part, but it's larger than a part for the whole. So I'm going to write in examples, see if I can get some. which is Sinidoki versus Metonymy, examples. It's a video, I think. Examples of Sinidoki are, hey man, nice threads. It says threads here refers to clothes, part of something referring to the whole. So, hey man, nice threads. Okay, now let's get a metonymy.
Yes, but it's like you said, for example, an example of metonymy, they give the White House set. It's
right, like, the White House.
America is saying, but it's not the country, it's the White House.
Right. For metonymy, I don't see this as very good, but it was the town's mechanic, not the rich lawyer, who had the nicest ride. Ride here is a metonym for car, because riding is something you do in an automobile. But the ride is not a part of the automobile, and therefore does not qualify as synecdoche. So it's similar to synecdoche, but not part of something. Just a substitution. When someone says you have nice kicks, that's a metonym for shoes. So anyways, why are we talking about this?
No, but about the communication and the audio tactile. How, for example, a word can substitute a whole concept or a whole...
Well, it's almost like metonymy is like, because there are more environments than what people were used to. How do you summarize the whole fact? You take the subway, go downtown, and you work in Wall Street, and you do all this stuff, and it's a whole environment because you have modern technology that creates all these environments. You need an image that swallows it all, whereas if you just live in the country, you can just talk about trees and bananas and things, you know, little objects. You're not as cluttered. So when metonymy is a new way of speaking about environments that are part of your being, that's what I would say. So you sum up a whole bunch of environmental processes when you say Wall Street.
Or White House, or...
Yeah, or White House, the White House.
Or non-physical.
Yeah, that's a good one, non-physical. Okay, so we were explaining what? The radio, what were we talking about that before we get into that? The compensating of the senses. So
yes.
So all of culture is environmental compensation going on. You know, when we bring in TV tactility, we extend our central nervous system with television. That means all the other senses, the kinetic, the visual, the acoustic, go into hyperdrive to balance off the tactile non-sensory level of TV, and therefore you have you know, loud rock music, Technicolor in movies, all the faster sport racing, car racing, the hyping up of all the old media environments as art forms and as extreme generators of wealth is caused by television. All the different environments, which are extensions of particular senses, whereas TV is an extension of a no sense, tactile interplay. So all this, all the content is all the sensory environments. They go into what I call Baroque spirals. And that's what happened. You had that great abundance of the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s of the analog media as the content of the global theater, which was epitomized by the TV screen. So it's an interplay of media that is the poetic vision of McLuhan. That's what you have to learn and start to notice. And then you'll see it's an ecology. Why did black power happen? Why did the Negro become black power? Because their tribalism was threatened by the instantaneous quality of mass communication. And color, TV came in, and the black looked better on TV than the white did on color TV. So that whole political movement and all the jargon that went into Huey Newton and the Black Panthers and all this paranoia they went into, they were responding, the acoustic tribal part of themselves was responding to the tactile effect of color TV. See, that's a broad way of looking at things.
Yes.
So, he will do this type of substitution for sensory. The media will be, like, he's making us aware that we're communicating not only with one sense, but they're all related.
Yeah, they're all talking to each other. Well, I missed the first sentence. You've got a slight echo. If you could, are you on speakerphone?
No.
Okay. What was your first sentence?
Yeah, that sometimes he, I have the impression he uses senses or media.
Yeah, they're interchangeable, yeah.
Because, like, media is an expansion of our senses.
Yes.
He will do this. That will
okay.
be a type of...
Here's what he would do. Hey, what?
That would be a synecdoche?
No, I don't think so. There might be, but I can't get my head around it this way because I want to emphasize something else. The tactile sense is not a sense. Tactile interplay organizes the sensory data coming into your brain. It organizes and makes coherent consciousness out of the input from the eye, ear, smell, movement, and kinetic pressure. So McLuhan said that we have extensions of our senses with these machinic environments that are body parts for the collective global body, the new body of that's interacting with all these extensions of our senses. So we need a new tactility that organizes these institutions and media extensions into a coherent consciousness. And he said we need something like an air traffic controller where they are in the airport and they're bringing in all these planes, imagine them as different kinds of sensory input, and making it coherent so they could land without interfering with each other. McLuhan says we have a global village of sensory chaos. We need a new centralization or global city. And he proposed that you use the computer to study the changes that are happening in global populations around the world, and that would be a form of a new sensus communis, the Latin word for tactile interplay, for forming coherent consciousness. So he proposed the integration of the extensions of the senses that nobody was doing or even aware of. That's pretty cosmic ambition. We need a brain, if people think the mind organizes your data. We need a brain or a mind technologically to organize the global extended environments, and the computer is the only technology that can do that. So when Understanding Media came out in 1964, there's an article where he's presenting huge designs of the big building where he would orchestrate and study the sensory thresholds of populations all over the world reacting to different media at different phases in their history. Hey, what do you think of that as an art project?
Yes, but he stopped at the nervous system.
That's right.
And you are adding the non-physical, which is the all-knowing or all...
That could be the tactile interplay that he was looking for. That you are at the center of the global sphere, and it's up to you to know and create a balance or an integration. See, the ball's in your court now. That's Ion's message. And Ion would say that. He said that the decentralization of the electronic environment leads to personal autonomy, but it's a juggling of environments, which I refine into different bodies. But he did say we need, management has to be able to do this. You have to program the whole planet. The individual is hopeless with all these mass environments. Now, he didn't write any predictions about how the media would shrink. He might have somewhere once, but the media were going to be these huge environments that needed global manipulation. They would become tiny little apps. So the Android Me made its own ecology, its own sensus communis, its own integrated tactile interface by shrinking everything into holopathic scale. So I'm going to go now look at my notes. for July 68. If you look at it.
Because I was thinking about what Ayan said. You have to explain how the Gutenberg galaxy is grown. And I was thinking maybe because the book made us classify and separate everything.
Yes.
That we are going to a technology that is more, that arranges everything more, it's like an orchestra or like...
well, the parts are communicating.
Integral, like to say holistic.
That's what he called it, total integral awareness. That was the new desire of the young people for integral awareness. To overcome the separate classified things and show how everything's connected and resonating off everything, echoing. That was the desire. So the electric media responded to the fragmentation caused by visual media, and so the whole 20th century is a correction to the 19th century.
Listen, and now I understand how you say this is the... how we heal the quadrophenia.
Yes. Yep.
The separations and the...
the bodies are fragmented off, and we tend to be visual and look at the... what was that word? Manifestation?
The fragmentation.
Fragmentation, right. So the... have this habitual habit of fragmenting and classifying things. So McLuhan said that the 20th century people lived mythically, that's integral awareness, but they thought fragmentedly. They still thought their content was the 19th century. So you have much of the last half of the 20th century is people trying to recover integral awareness. They feel the need for it. They don't know their environment has done it through television, but they're feeling the need for it, and they are running around with generally conceptual ways of doing it. That's all the human potential New Age stuff. Then there's other kinds of attempts by making one thing be everything. They become a drug addict or a alcoholic or a sex addict or a career addict or a homeless person, you know, specializing. But putting your all, trying to make that one aspect of yourself mean everything. So that would be synecdoche, taking a part and making it the whole. Is that what synecdoche was? Or was the opposite, taking a whole and making it a part?
Oh.
They're taking a part to represent the whole.
The whole, yeah.
Yeah. That's probably what... I think Croker in his essay on McLuhan ends by saying McLuhan's metaphor made us all a metonymy, something like that. He used those terms. But, yeah, most people respond to the integrated environment, which is a metaphorical resonating situation, as synecdoche. They take the whole and emphasize a specialist part and make the part the whole deal. That's a fragmented response.
And I see how we evolved to the multimedia, because the book was like hypnotizing us into this fragmentation. And with the multimedia, we try to achieve that integral awareness, as you say.
Yeah, right. Yeah, McLuhan said in the 60s, the desire for integral awareness, the person would... he'd go drive in his car and have a kinetic experience. Then he'd come home and want to have an ear experience, so he'd listen to radio. Then he'd want to have a tactile experience or visual tactile, and then he would watch TV. And then he'd have a literary experience, so he'd read a newspaper. And Ion saw the 1960s person rotating through media environments throughout their day. Get on the telephone for interactive. Now, all of those separate analog media environments that we rotated through now are all in one integrated singularity, the iPhone. So you drive your car, you hear your music, and you do all these particular things within one little environment. So that's the seamless web. And that's probably synesthesia. That's synesthesia.
Jason, and I see how we are now evolving into the holograms.
Yeah. The hologram is the shrinking. The shrinking. The more involving and the shrinking. Tinier and tinier. Like people, when I walk along the beach and they're all lined up on their sun deck chairs and they're all just they're ignoring the water and looking at their iPhones, they're all doing it. They're all living, you might as well put a chip inside their head. That's just a later development. They're all inside the hologram of their little iPhone screen.
Mm.